Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is John Tresh. He is a professor of history of art, science, and folk practice at the Warburg Institute in the University of London. And we're talking about his new book, The Reason for the Darkness of the Night, Edgar Allan Poe and the Forging of American Science. John, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
John, I'm a huge fan of Edgar Allan Poe, but I have to say that we in America, when we think about Edgar Allan Poe, we think about weird stories of the fantastic and the grotesque. Probably the last thing we think about is science. How did you come to this story?
Well, by reading Edgar Allan Poe himself. If you actually get back to some of the stories, not really the ones that are the best known. It's not that obvious in, say, The Fall of the House of Usher or The Black Cat, but if you dig a little deeper into his collected works, you start to find stories like Mesmeric Revelation or The Balloon Hoax or Descent into the Maelstrom, and then you realize he's talking about things that he's imagining, but also things that are really connected to the sciences of his time. And then I read a little further. There's an incredible collection by Harold Beaver, the Penguin Edgar Allan Poe science fiction, that has just these astounding footnotes that point to lots and lots of the connections between what he's writing and what's going on in science. And it includes his final kind of masterpiece, his very strange masterpiece, Eureka. And that, to me, was just the ultimate enticement. I read those footnotes. I knew there was a lot more to learn. And then I just started to get into it and read not just Poe, but read around him, read about the things going on in science of his time internationally, and realized it was a period of a lot of scientific change, and that showed up in Poe's writing.
As a matter of fact, you write, and this is a quote, "To understand his life and his work demands close attention to his engagements with scientific thought and discoveries of the time." For people who aren't familiar with the life of Poe, we're talking about sort of the early to mid 19th century, right?
That's right. He had a tragically short life, born in 1809, died in 1849. And it's 50 years, he's born about 50 years after the Revolution. That's all celebrated in his lifetime. The Marquis of Lafayette comes through town after having been so important in fighting the Revolutionary War. 50 years later, comes back through the States, does a tour of all the major cities, and winds up in Richmond. So that sense of the country having just got started, but having a little bit of history under its belt, the War of 1812 Poe lived through, of course, that's a big moment, you know, in kind of redefining what it means to be an independent and unified nation. And that, of course, is not yet resolved in his period, but people are starting to think about that. What is America? What is American culture? And how are all the new industries and the new sciences of this period going to affect that? How can they be used to build an American nation, to build an American culture? How is the railroad or the telegraph or new canals or coal or all the sciences needed to map the land of this continent, how are they going to be part of this new country? And that's a big part of what's going on in the background of Poe's writings. One of the things that a lot of people don't realize, I mean, is that Poe is actually writing of the United States. He frequently sets his stories in some really remote place, a misty place out of space, out of time, or, you know, the domain of Arnheim or the House of Usher. You don't know where those are, and often it seems like they're in European Gothic settings. But a lot of what he's dealing with are issues and ideas that are circulating in his time in the U.S. So one of the things I wanted to do in the book is just make it really clear how much that American context is part of what's going on in his writing, even when he's, you know, leaping off into outer space or into the imagination or into those weird Gothic landscapes of the past.
What is the state of science in sort of the world at this point? Is the word science even being used? You mentioned a lot about natural philosophy.
Great question. Natural philosophy is the term that is used for what we would now call physics. People do talk about science, but the term scientist itself wasn't coined until 1833 during Poe's lifetime. So science exists, but it's been changing quite a lot since the days of Newton and Kepler and Galileo. And Poe's really aware of the history of science. He's really aware of the changes it's gone through in the previous couple of hundred years. what's changed before his lifetime is that it's been extremely successful. All the different sciences have developed in lots of different ways. But the success has actually brought a new problem, which is geology and biology and astronomy and physics don't speak the same language anymore. Natural philosophy was the term that Aristotle used for the unified approach to nature. And it was a single system, you know, a single set of explanations for everything. But by the early 19th century, all the sciences have really developed. They've learned a lot about their different domains, but they have a really hard time talking to each other. They're super specialized. They have their own esoteric jargon and language, and they don't really communicate or really tie together. And that's a problem for a lot of people in the period. They want to know, what do all the sciences have in common? How can we unite them? How can we get a unified picture of nature or a unified picture of the cosmos? And that's one of the big issues that Poe himself is wrestling with. And there's different suggestions about how you might do this, different ways of classifying the sciences, tying them together historically or conceptually. But one of the big ideas is to say that there is a single scientific method that connects all of the sciences. So the notion of method is everywhere in Poe's time, and it's one of the ideas that he picks up and runs with in his own stories, in his satires, in his writing about science, and even in his own thinking about what it is to write a good poem or a good story. He really takes the notion of method very, very
seriously. That's right, that's right.
It's the big term for science at the time.
But it's more complicated than that, because another quote from your book, that he wrote both with and against emerging scientific consensus. So explain that.
Yeah, that is part of what's so complicated. And that's part of what I was wrestling with in writing about this author who is so well known, so well studied, but this aspect of him hasn't really been studied in depth and hasn't been tied together as really the unifying theme of his life, which is what I try to do. Some people have looked at Poe and said, oh, he's just a typical romantic. He's into aesthetics. He's into subjective responses. He's into nature, and he thinks that technology and kind of analytical mathematical science is the wrong way to approach the world. And there's lots in his writing that sounds just like that, where he's skeptical or satirical. He's making fun of what scientists are saying when they're claiming to be able to explain the world according to a few simple principles.
Well, wait a minute. One of the big things about Romanticism was the sublime.
Yes.
And certainly that sense of awe, horror, and admiration are in Poe's stories. So in part, he is a romantic.
That's definitely true. And he knows his Coleridge, his Wordsworth. He's steeped in romanticism. He's kind of modeling himself on Byron in his early works and throughout, you know, the kind of doomed, haunted poet who's you know, in a way too pure for this world, the accursed poet. He's definitely a romantic.
Now, but I was going to say, there's nothing simple about Poe. After reading your book, I realized that whatever you can say, it's almost like you can say the opposite.
Yeah, I come back again and again to the image of the kaleidoscope, which is a tool, a toy that's invented during his lifetime by David Brewster, a Scottish physicist who he cites and borrows from all the time. And it's the sense that the picture's always changing. You're rearranging these elements into a new image at every moment. So he's definitely romantic, but somebody like Brewster, he's making these new wonderful, sublime works of art, these new toys to produce these new kinds of visions, like the kaleidoscope, but he's also an empirical, exact mathematical scientist. And Poe is steeped in that, too. He's got his feet really solidly on the ground in everything that's happening in science internationally at this time. And the reasons for that are, you know, there are lots, but he has a really good education in Richmond as a child in various academies. He spends some time at the University of Virginia in its second year, New university. And then when he gets kicked out of the house, kicked out of the home of his foster father, John Allen, he has to find his own way in the world. He joins the army. And in the army, he eventually works his way up the ranks and becomes the artificer for his troop. An artificer is the person who fixes all the equipment, who fixes the weapons, who makes bullets, who fixes guns, who polishes the lenses of telescopes. So this is very technical work, very scientific. It's very exact. You make a mistake, and the bomb that you're working on can blow up in your face. So this kind of technical skill, he's learning it in the army, and after the army, right afterward, he joins West Point Military Academy.
And he studies
the best scientific training.
Right, he studies sciences while he's at West Point.
Excuse me?
He studies sciences while he's at West Point.
Exactly, as people do today. You get a training in engineering and science as well as in military drill. And the West Point had just been reformed when Poe got there. It had brought in all the cutting-edge physical science and engineering from France that had been developing over the previous years at the École Polytechnique, the polytechnical school that's the model for engineering schools around the world. West Point picked up that model, and Poe was exposed to this extremely rigorous course of training in mathematics and in French. So when C-Auguste Dupin shows up as his detective, as in his detective stories, there's actually an engineer and mathematician named Charles Dupin, whose books are in the library at West Point. The sciences, the physical and mathematical sciences, spoke French at the time that Poe was learning them, and he knew both of those languages.
Now, did he write an ode to science in 1830?
The date may, I think, I'm not sure of the date, but he definitely wrote a sonnet to science in one of his first books of poetry.
You quote it in the book, and it's very weird. Sciences dragged Diana from her car.
Yeah.
Weird imagery.
Yeah, definitely. It's the idea of science kind of violently grabbing the parts of the world that we have understood previously through a kind of magical or mythological or poetic lens. So Diana is the goddess of the moon, and the idea is that she's every time she crosses the sky, she's riding in her chariot through the night. And science has dragged her from her car and with its vulture eyes peers into the secrets of nature and removes all their enchantment, all their poetry, and has replaced them with this really dry, dull, dead view of nature as just simple causes, mathematics, empirical observation. So in a way, that poem is saying, science, here's this new goddess, science. What have you done? Well, you've dispelled all the other gods, all the other mythology and poetry the world, and left us with what? And the poem is actually a question, right? It's in a way, it's a critique of poetry, of science, and the way it's harmed poetry, but it's also a question. In the center of the poem, he asks, how should a poet love thee, science? How should he love science? How deem thee wise? And he doesn't resolve that question in the poem. But my suggestion is that the rest of his life, he's wrestling with that question. Starting as a romantic poet, how can you make sense of and make a place for this really radical new way of seeing the world, which is science and technology? How can you embrace it? How can you make sense of its way of understanding the world without setting it aside, without denying it, but also without succumbing to its really visible power? So in his life, in many, many different ways, he answers that question by finding new bridges between poetry, art, and science.
Could it be said that probably a lot of artists, both literary and even visual artists at that time, were wrestling with the same issues? It really sort of, when I finished your book, I got the feeling this was the end of the period of romanticism and the rise of science, and it has to have affected a lot of artists at that time.
Yeah, they're wrestling with it in lots of ways. And for a long time, I think a lot of people had a hard time seeing that engagement between artists and scientists in the 19th century. We tend to look back with 20th century eyes, which say, well, there's art on one hand that's all about subjectivity, mind.
And then there was a stop. There was a curtain that fell down and everybody got scientific.
Yeah, exactly. And in the 19th century, especially in Poe's period, there's so much cross-fertilization between these worlds. So the sublime, which you mentioned, that's an aesthetic resource, you know, getting overwhelmed by a view of nature, by something which is so colossal that you can't process it with your mind. That's part of painting, that's part of poetry, but it's also part of the vision of the world of Alexander von Humboldt. It's also part of the kinds of descriptions of astronomy that you find in William Whewell or in Laplace. These are the important astronomers of the time. So there's a very similar aesthetics to the sciences and the arts, and likewise, the kind of scientific attention to observation, to the senses, to physiology, to precision, that's informing a lot of the poetry and art. To describe the natural world in its exact forms, how does it manifest to you? That means bringing with it the aesthetic and subjective experience of that same precise observation. And it really moves back and forth. Poe is just one fairly extreme example of something that's much more widespread.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is John Tresh. He is a professor of history of art, science, and folk practice at the Warburg Institute in the University of London. And we're talking about his book, The Reason for the Darkness of the Night, Edgar Allan Poe and the Forging of American Science. John, I just explain the darkness of the night before, and I don't want to have this interview end and you not talk about how you got that title.
Well, for starters, I was inspired by the term came to me, and I realized it scanned in iambic pentameter, which is something that Poe would appreciate. He spent a lot of time counting the syllables in each line of poetry and arguing for what the best balance of them was, and he can't argue with iambic pentameter. But the image itself, I think, it connects so many different parts of his life. We know him as the poet and the author of The Darkness, of the creepy things that happen at night, the black cat, the kind of the dark side of the human mind, the what he calls the perverse, the tendency of humans to do the thing which is exactly against their interest. It's a bit like Freud's death drive. So there's so much dark imagery that's literally of the nighttime and fighting against the light in various ways. And that's one reason that Poe is slightly different from some of the romantics before him.
Right.
He brings out that darker chord, the kind of hidden side of the human mind, the hidden side of nature. Nature's not all about harmony and beauty. There's also discord and destruction within it. But more specifically, the reason for the darkness of the night is something that Poe himself came up with.
I know.
One of his final works, Eureka, which is a very, very strange book. It's a cosmological theory, an explanation of the origin of the universe and of its eventual destruction. As a kind of aside, in that book, he came up with a solution to what's known at the time as Olbers' paradox, which Olbers is a Prussian astronomer who asked the question, if Newton's view of the universe is true, and Newton thought that the universe was infinite and filled with stars in every possible direction. If that view of the universe is true, why aren't those infinite stars lighting up the night sky? Why is the night sky dark? And very simply, Poe said, well, the answer is that the universe is not infinite. It had a beginning, and it will have an end. And that was a radical thing to be saying at the time. And it's the explanation for why the night sky is dark that physicists accept today.
It's a very interesting time for science, and you detail it so well in the book. There's a lot of humbuggery masquerading as science going on. A lot of lecturers going around lecturing. They seem like they know what they're talking about the grand views of science, but a lot of it's sort of BS. But it's also the beginning of the American Association for the Advancement of Science.
Exactly.
And it begins at that
and
time.
And those two things are going hand in hand.
They're trying to sort out. They're trying to sort out the wheat from the chaff, and that's one of their goals.
And that's exactly why Poe is so hard to pin down. It's one of the reasons, because he's on both sides of this divide.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got this. It's a media revolution, very much like the one that we've lived through, where there, you know, instead of everything going online, suddenly there are printing presses that are using steam engines to produce thousands of copies of every magazine, and new journals and newspapers coming from every direction. They're transported along canals and railroads. They're instantly or very quickly available, and it's really hard to make sense of where these things are coming from, who's saying what, who should you believe. At the same time, there's itinerant lecturers going through what are called the Lyceum halls of the country, talking about physics, poetry, literature, and science. But you don't know who are legitimate scientists and who are the quacks or the charlatans telling some story that they just made up. Two big examples of sciences that we now consider pseudosciences came into existence in Poe's time. Phrenology, or we really talked about it.
Right.
Phrenology, which is the science of character, where by looking at the bumps on people's heads, that you can sort of read their personality by the shape of their skulls. And also mesmerism, which we now think of as hypnosis. That was the theory that there's an invisible fluid connecting people, and that if you learn how to harness and alter that fluid, you can affect people's minds and actually take control of their wills and allow them to access hidden realms of reality. Both of those were a big part of the popular press, a big part of these circuits of lectures, of scientific lectures, and they were presented as sciences. And many serious scientists took them as serious sciences. So it was really hard to know what were legitimate, rigorous ways of seeing the world, and what was just bunk or charlatanism. people would happily pay for either. This is also the era of P.T. Barnum. He opens his American Museum during post-career, which shows a lot of really legitimate science, you know, interesting rocks, interesting inventions, alongside total hoaxes like the Fiji mermaid.
I know. Okay, John, we're going to run out of time. And I want to ask you, you analyze a lot of his work in depth in this book. But I want to talk about the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym, because that story I find deeply bizarre, bizarre. And then I read your analysis of it, and it got deeply more bizarre. You talk about the theme of symmetry and inversion in the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym. It was written in 1837. There's a couple of things that are going on. A lot of hollow earth ideas were popular at that time.
Yep.
But talk to me about symmetry and inversion. You reprint the title page, and I had never seen that before, where it looks like it's a mirror image of a ship.
That's right. So symmetry is there, right in the imagery of the title page, for sure. And inversion, in the sense that you're going from the north. I'm not surprised you're asking, given where you are. He sails out from Nantucket. And eventually, Arthur Gordon Pym winds up on a boat heading to the extreme south of the world and heading towards the South Pole. And there is a theory going around that if you get to the poles, you will find that there's not a cap. There's just a hole there that allows you to go into the center of the earth, and there will be a habitable land full of animals and plants. That theory was out there, and a lecturer had gone through town. Poe knew him in Richmond. Saying the U.S. needs to sponsor an expedition to the South to test this theory. And right as that expedition was getting prepared, Poe wrote the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym to give people a taste, imaginatively, of what you might find at the bottom of the earth. And in the story, it's a really, really weird story.
Yeah, don't give it away. Don't give it away. I think it's the strangest ending of any Poe story.
It's certainly up there. But part of what he got from the sciences was this methodological approach to writing. And for him, the method that you had to follow was to put everything in your story, aim it at a single effect. So in a way, everything's directed towards the ending. So there are a lot of really shocking and surprising endings, but you're right. Pym ends with just so many questions. There's a lot of answers, but even more questions. And the boat, in a way, flips upside down. The whole narrative flips upside down at the exact halfway in the novel. That some scholars have discovered that before, that there is actually a kind of mirroring effect in the book, Pym, that everything that happens in the first chapter is repeated in a slightly modified form in the last chapter, and that keeps repeating itself as you get close to the middle. And the middle is sort of the ground zero of the story, where everything flips over and then the story starts up again, but in a kind of transformed, fantastical form. And I think it's as though it's gone through a technology that Poe was aware of, the camera obscura, which was a way of seeing a machine that showed you the world, in the images of the world, in an inverted form. And so it's like a weird magic lantern show that Poe takes Pym and the reader for as they go below the equator toward the source of mystery.
Your book begins and ends with a public lecture that he's giving called The Universe. And I never would have expected, I knew nothing about that, and that was a surprise to me. We just have a few minutes left. Talk to me about that lecture. That's a scientific lecture.
It is, and it's also a poem. It's a poetic lecture, too. And that's, you know, part of what's amazing about it and amazing about him. Those two are always combined. So after, you know, he had this extremely tragic life, you know, just terribly impoverished, desperate, have a real problem with alcohol. And his wife, his very young wife, who was also his cousin, died of tuberculosis when she was very young. After that, he set himself to write this new work, which would be, in a way, the summation of everything he'd done before. And he called it The Universe. When it was published, he called it Eureka. I discovered, I found it. And that's the lecture he gave in New York in early 1848 as a way of kind of getting back into the literary scene. And he hoped that it would transform the worlds of philosophy and science. But it snowed that night, and only a few people turned up.
Oh, yeah, I know. Oh, God.
But the lecture was a history of the universe, how it started with a single particle and then exploded outward and then eventually came back together. And certain astrophysicists now think that this may have been an inspiration for the Big Bang, because the people who came up with that theory, Friedman and Lemaître, they would have known Poe's work. Friedman said Poe's one of his favorite authors. So in a weird way, even though it's this really experimental lecture that's way out there, and really against the kinds of things that the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, is trying to set up to discount these kinds of speculations, even though it's really way out there, it may have led to the theory of the universe that we now take seriously today.
Why is that not better known?
One of the reasons is that Poe was so successful in setting up a view of literature that was purely ideal. He said that you should set aside any kinds of material theories or material reasons for why someone wrote a poem. Just consider it on formal terms. That meant that people read his stories and didn't really think about the context. Therefore, the things that didn't seem like ordinary literature, or, you know, that were about imagination and beauty, all his science writing, and there's tons of it, they kind of left aside. Plus, it's a really weird work. It's very difficult. It's not an easy work at all. And I really wanted to explain it in quite a clear way. I even came up with a diagram that I'm kind of happy with the process of that he's describing. But I think it was just too much for people to make sense of, especially since we have this idea that Poe is the author of the irrational, of the imaginative. Yep,
exactly.
Science is supposed to not be.
Right. That's what's emphasized. We're completely out of time. My guest tonight has been John Tresh. He's a professor of history of art, science, and folk practice at the Warburg Institute at the University of London. And we've been talking about his new book. It's a fascinating book, not only just about the subject, it's a great biography of Edgar Allan Poe. The Reason for the Darkness of the Night, Edgar Allan Poe and the Forging of American Science. John, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it has been. Thanks so much.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.